Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
You're listening to The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. And we are joined now by Nathan Smith, who has extensive media experience and interest in public policy. He's previously known for his work at NBR. He's currently writing for Good Oil News as a columnist, as well as I am. And he's also previously been interviewed by Cameron Slater on Reality Check Radio. So welcome back, Nathan.
Thanks, Debo. Thanks for having me.
On the subject of the media, I've been thinking recently of how tightly the media are controlling the US election. Basically, they propped up Joe Biden, even though he clearly wasn't mentally fit in any way, and they hid that very, very well until the debates. And even after that, they were carrying water for him for just a little bit. And then when they realized it cracked, they tanked him in the space of like 24, 48 hours. They brought in Kamala Harris. The media in the United States haven't even interviewed her a single time as of 90 days out of the election. They're very reluctant to cover Trump. He's only really getting exposure through going on X with Elon Musk and going around the media. So what role does the media play then in the election, keeping it basically competitive? That's what it looks like to me. Like a single interview, they could destroy Kamala Harris, basically. That's how tight the control the media has over the US election. That's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, well, probably a good way to frame this is to remember back to Trump's first administration, back in the halcyon days of 2016 to 20. There was a moment quite early on in his administration, actually, when he sent a press release out on Twitter. This is before Elon Musk. So nobody bought it. It was still the old Twitter. But he sent it, and everyone was sort of like, oh, this is fantastic. He's using a new medium. But I looked at it and thought, what he's just done there is he has sent a government missive to everybody at once with literally no media. The reason why this is important is that in the past, there's been a certain kind of subsidy that the media gets, and that is access to officials. It's a certain kind of subsidy that no one else, you and I, can't get it. We don't get the embargoed press releases. We don't get invited to the secret meetings. We don't get a phone call at 3 a.m. saying, here's some news coming up at 9 a.m. Do you want to get ahead of this? Only the journalists, only the media is a privileged class when it comes to that. In Trump's first administration, he cut all of that out and gave us, what I thought, a very democratic approach to government, which is no one gets that subsidy anymore. This is your government, and you should get the information at the same time as everybody else, so no one can get ahead of it. I don't think that's why they hate him. I think they hate him for many reasons. But what he proved there is, once and for all, I think, that the legacy media really has no place anymore. And they're trying to relive the early days prior to Trump, which is where the media gets apoplectic when it tries to have more than two sides to any story. So there's a blue and a red side, there's a left and a right side, but if you try to be a third candidate, they'll never talk to you. So now it's possible for all different kinds of candidates to stand up and say, I'm going to compete for the White House. You've got RFK Jr., you've got Bernie Sanders is a classic one. There's many other people in America, even in New Zealand, our MMP sort of allows for that. But still, our legacy media really struggles to discuss more than two topics at once because it likes that binary system. What Trump did, I think, in that moment was historical. I think the history books will be the judge of this. But what he did there was completely reveal that the information we have now can be released to everybody. And these archaic 20th century methods of making sure you give it to the media before it gets to everybody else are long gone. Another good example is we don't need embassies anymore. Embassies are an archaic 19th century invention, for crying out loud. If you want to get in touch with Washington, send them an email. You don't need to go down to the embassy down in Wellington or the consulate up in Auckland. It's ridiculous. We should be sending all diplomats home because that institution in itself is redundant. And I only use that as an example because legacy media still today is a dead man walking. They are trying to control the narrative in a way that they don't have the power for anymore. Your point earlier about Trump being interviewed by Elon Musk this week is pertinent because, again, that went out to everybody on a platform. And American law has already imbued that the platform cannot be held responsible for any of the information placed on it. You know, just as you see in the UK today, people can be arrested, but they can't arrest the owners of Twitter or Facebook. They can't fine them. They are considered to be, under American law, a platform, not a producer. Whereas, so they can't be held under libel or defamation or anything like that. Whereas the New York Times can. And I think, again, you're just proving that the old systems of media are getting more and more redundant as these platforms grow in power. And they're trying very hard to maintain the narrative. But I'll be honest, no one opens up the New York Times, at my age anyway, no one opens up the New York Times or the Herald every morning to see what's going on. The first thing they do is jump on social media because that's where it's at.
But a lot of social media stories are still driven by what's published in the mainstream media, I guess. And that's why they're pushing here in New Zealand the government to give them more money from social media, basically. The Fair News Digital Bargaining Bill, I forget the exact name, but it's got one of those names that are false, as many bills have. Like the name is the opposite of what it really means. But you still have the New Zealand Herald like in a fight with Hobson's Pledge at the moment over advertising. And also, you know, basically rejecting their advertising now, potentially being boycotted by the Maori Party. It seems like they still have a lot of influence because they're still pushing for the government to fund them. They're still, you know, everyone's still talking about them. They seem to have a lot more power than someone like you or I might give them credit for.
Yeah, I think there's, you have to sort of remember that probably you and I are, for want of a better phrase, news junkies. So we still follow quite a lot of the news, but I'll be honest, even with the Olympics just recently finished, a lot of people who I was talking about said, you know, I said cynically to them, are you watching anything on the media for the Olympics? And almost to a person, they said, not really. So, I mean, if they aren't watching the Olympics, which you would consider to be sort of a worldwide stage, everybody should be watching, eyeballs should be on it. How little are they consuming the Herald or other things? It's probably... the numbers they give you about exactly how many eyeballs there are probably inflated. I know for a fact that the Herald used to count one newspaper being sent to a school, used to count the number of readers as the number of pupils who are potentially at that school, just through one subscription. So completely inflated numbers. And I think the, you know, driving the narrative from the media, so, you know, just check on Twitter to see what the Herald is saying, I think is natural because it's the least friction form of finding news. If the Herald goes out and does the legwork of writing the story, it's pretty easy for Twitter then to copy paste and say, here's what is going on in the news. But you'll find that most of the news actually that the Herald picks up on, if it's not political stuff, comes from Twitter and other social media in the first place. You know, a person taking a video of something will then find itself on Reddit or on Telegram or somewhere. A journalist will go on there and grab it and turn that into a news story. So it's a real question of who's actually driving the news cycle at the moment. It's unclear. I'd say it's 50-50, maybe 70-30 towards social media. That trend is only going to continue. And I think that's important to watch out for.
Now, a lot of these media organizations used to be fairly prestigious, and there used to be a lot more of them that covered the political spectrum. Like you used to have sort of more right-leaning mainstream media and various other influential groups influencing public opinion and policy. But there seems to be have been a massive decay of right-leaning influence in the area that we now call the legacy media that happened over several decades. And if, you know, if we didn't have social media sort of and the ability to create new media, like we have you know, the ability to write for Good Oil News, we have the ability to come here on Reality Check Radio and talk freely. There used to be more, for lack of a better term, right-leaning groups in the public eye. That was sort of subverted, that decayed over time. Many people have probably heard of the march through the institutions, sort of a theory of how Marxists and communists kind of infiltrated every bureaucracy, every large institution, and subverted it and decayed them over time. How did something like that happen, and how do we stop it from happening again? You know, how do we stop history from repeating itself? That natural cycle of entropy. If we've defeated the legacy media, how do we stop the next mistake from happening?
Yes, good question. It's very pertinent. I witnessed actually, and you used the word decay, I think quite accurately, of right-wing media working for the NBR, which was classically known by its blue colours. It's specifically chosen for that by the original NBR owner, Barry Coleman, because he understood that it was not a mouthpiece and not necessarily a flag-waving outlet, but it was definitely aligned to how the National Party thought. And it used to be the case that, you know, a lot of the bigwigs in the National Party would call him up, or they would be biennial events where all the who's who of the Conservative Party in New Zealand would turn up, and they would all discuss what's the plan for the future, how can media help, what's NBR's doing for this, not in those explicit terms, but it was implicit that, you know, the NBR would at least be kinder to the business narrative, which tended to be more National's wheelhouse. Barry Coleman's big understanding of what media is, I think, is a perfect example of why everything has decayed. He understood, like Rupert Murdoch did and others of his generation, that media was something other. It wasn't, you can't put it into a business. It's not part of that sector. It's not part of ag. It's not part of fisheries. It's nothing. It's sort of tangential to that. It structures itself as a business. There's an editor who is similar to a CEO who gets to make executive decisions. And then there's a whole bunch of middle managers and then line workers who churn out the product. And of course, they connect with actual industry like printers or distribution networks like the Post. But it's a mistake to think of it as a business. Its profit motive is not necessarily counted in money. Its profit motive is counted differently, and that is in status collection and access. Journalists know that their ability to get on the front page, they're rarely as good as the last story that they wrote and who they can talk to when it matters. That their access is paramount. So if they can call up a prominent CEO or a politician and get them to comment immediately before the presses, that's very, very important. And that will get them on the front page. The ability to get on the front page is also something that those politicians and CEOs and movers or players of this world will notice. If you are the kind of journalist who can get on the front page, they will talk to you. If over a handful of weeks you suddenly fall to page two, page three, and in the back sections, you'll never get on the front page again because you won't get the good news. So that's why, generally speaking, over time, although it has sort of changed as media has become a business, journalists don't tend to get paid very well. Most journalists tended to come from trust funds. They had a welfare net that their dads and grandfathers set up, which means that they didn't have to get a salary as high competitively as their peers because they weren't getting paid in money. They were getting paid in prestige, status, and access. They could be invited to the cool parties and that where they would talk to people. So tomorrow they could get the story. And it used to be that you didn't want to invite journalists to parties because they'd tell the story. That was the days of yellow journalism at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century. You just, you know, there were flies you wanted to see buzz off. But as the 20th century walked on, and, you know, we can say because we're amongst friends, communism gained more power. It was understood by the who's who, the noble class, the upper classes, who had this trust fund welfare net, that if they got into the media, they could advance their message and their cause faster because that dominated the narrative. And whoever dominates the narrative dominates the voters. So they realized, very simple maths, that the more of them they got into media, the faster things could work for them. And so you ended up seeing media being used not as a tool necessarily, but more as a weapon. And that's always really been what media is. It's not a business. It's something you use to create and structure society in the direction that you want it to go in. And everybody that's aligned with you will come along for that ride so that when that new society or new structures are created, they can be in power. And everybody on that quiet little movement understands that process. And I think where the 20th, 21st century has sort of failed, and why we see such a dearth of media, such a decay of media, to use your good words there, is because a lot of the new generation, I'd say Generation Y, came into ownership of media or into prominence in media, and they thought it was just like everything else. They thought it was a business, that all you needed to do was increase subscriptions and people would read your news. But that's never really been what news was about. News was about controlling people's minds. And that's why you had, back in the early days of sort of mainstream news, and mainstream news really came out of the Department of Information ministries across the
propaganda,
West.
Propaganda, basically.
Yeah.
The term propaganda comes from that.
That's right. In Germany, they called it propaganda. In America, they called it public relations, but it's the same thing. And as those ministries and departments of information were dissolved after World War II, they ended up becoming big mainstream media organizations. And the same people, actually, who were involved in creating propaganda for World War II ended up being senior journalists. And that sort of carried that legacy on. But as you say, it sort of decayed over time. And I think what you have now is the owners of media have forgotten what it's for. That if you actually spent money early on to structure society in 20 years' time, you and your buddies could make a lot of money then, but you had to bide your time, because now all your buddies are in powerful positions because you and rest of your nobles and upper class and people who have the ability and the time to write good news have got them in those positions. The entry worked. And that tool now, I think, is sort of being sitting around unused, I think, on the right, which is why I think there's a lot of people who are seeing the social media platforms as a new weapon. And you start to see, rather than propaganda, you see memes, which are basically the same thing, a way to control the narrative. But I saw this, to answer your question earlier, I saw this in NBR, where, love him to bits, but Todd Scott, who presently is the publisher, he was never a classically trained journalist or even, you know, was comfortable writing, but he was a great businessman. And so he saw the opportunity with NBR to turn it into and grow its readership size. But as he did that, he realized it wasn't even a decision on his part. It was more like a default inertia, that the NBR ended up becoming more mainstream and more center of the line, saying just normal things. And because, as you and I know, there's no such thing as the center. The center always moves left over time. It ended up that NBR just basically was saying the same thing as the rest of the mainstream news. And it was a real struggle to differentiate what message the NBR had from the Business Herald or from other business media. And I think that has made it struggle, because you, as a reader, you're not quite sure why you should spend your money in that direction as opposed to the other direction, when the things on the shelf look pretty much the same. And that was never really a conscious thing on behalf of the NBR leadership. It's just that they, I think, took their eye off the ball and forgot what media actually was, and the people they were hiring, as constant, you know, normal natural churn happens, just ended up being the people who would follow the mainstream narrative message. They just happened to be extremely good journalists, and they chose NBR as their next port of call. And it ended up being that, rather than the people who are more right-aligned, it ended up just being the people who got sick and tired of working at the Herald or Stuff, and they came to NBR. So you ended up having exactly the same message being replayed on NBR through no one's fault. It's just something that just happened, because no one was holding standards, and no one was remembering what media actually was. That's what I experienced.
And this is something that I would apply to basically every organization, really. I always think of Robert Conquest and his three laws of politics. And I'll just list them out here for the listeners. If you've never heard of Conquest's laws, there's three of them. The first one is that everyone is conservative about what he knows best. The second is that any organization not explicitly and constitutionally right-wing will sooner or later become left-wing. And that could be applied to any political position. And third, the behavior of any bureaucratic organization can be understood best by assuming it is controlled by a secret cabal of its enemies. And in that last one, he gave the example of like the post-World War II British Secret Service, which was basically controlled by communists as an example. And it was supposed to be a bastion of Western values and so on. But the decay is a good example. The second law, Conquest's second law, you see brought up a lot, because it has to do with how you define your organization, what it's supposed to be doing. And it could be applied to our, in our own circles here, Voices for Freedom, Reality Check Radio, like constitutionally defining what our purpose is, what our goals are, what we're doing, and then maintaining those is really important because you're basically fighting a battle against entropy, which is that leftward drift. We may as well describe that as a left-wing drift, as like the natural way of things. If you don't maintain them, they will drift leftward because that's the natural state of the universe. And so you have to very actively maintain these standards, these goals that you have. And maybe a more difficult question for you then is like, how do you do that? Like, how do you constitutionally, explicitly maintain the goals, the values that you've set for your organization?
Yeah, it's you have to start with first principles, I think. What are you actually trying to achieve? What is the ideal outcome to which, if you follow a path, you will arrive? And you said it correctly, you need to outline first what you are. So people throw around the word right. When if you go back to its etymology, you see that it goes back to the tennis court and the French Revolution, where people were either wanting to go full speed ahead with the revolution or maybe just slow it down a little bit. Maybe we can clean up the mess that we've created, but we're still going to deconstruct. It's not a problem. We'll just go a little bit slower. That's the origin of what we get as today's progressives and today's conservatives. Conservatives have never conserved anything. They just make things go slower for the progressives. But real rightism, so to speak, you would need to define yourself for what your group wants to uphold. At its deepest core, it's about private property. And in terms of structure of government, it would be monarchical. The idea of having a single CEO or a king at the top who delegates powers and to whom all powers are invested, very concentrated power. It's the opposite of, say, oligarchy or democracy, which is a bit more preferred by chaos. And what we would call leftism.
And you could go one step further now and describe it as bureaucracy or managerial democracy, basically, where nobody really knows where the power lies. No one's responsible. Like if you have a true right-wing government, as it were, the monarch, the CEO, like there's someone who you understand, like, okay, that person is accountable. That person is responsible for what happens. And we kind of reach the point now with a more chaotic form where like, who's actually to blame can just be passed off to the next layer of management and the next, there's processes where you're doing this process and that process and everyone's just following their instructions and no one's to blame for anything going wrong.
Yeah. So that's the first point I would make is define your terms. What does your group, what does your media outlet, what does your business, what does your community, what values do they have? And make them explicit. The second subset of that is hold standards. If you don't have standards, you don't have anything. All you have really is like a Sunday garden party. I've seen this in, when I was growing up in churches where standards weren't upheld. Depending on, wherever you come from in your religion, there will be certain standards that you are called to uphold. If you don't uphold those standards, that is a way of introducing decay into that institution. So if it's suddenly okay for the pastor to commit adultery or to divorce his wife or to estrange his son or something, then why shouldn't it be okay for me as a congregant to also do the same thing? So, but if you ask that pastor to leave and then mercifully or forgive him and then he's allowed to come back in, you're also saying to the rest of the congregants, it's okay to do that because one day we're just going to forget and forgive. And
this is all too common now in Christianity and as part of, it's a really big problem in Christianity.
Yeah. Standards are hard to maintain because that you feel like you're being the bad guy. But that's why we write laws and standards down. So we don't have to say, I'm making this decision. The words on the paper that we all agreed to, they're making the decision on my behalf. So get angry at the words, but I'm just following them. And you need to be a strong person to do that. Now, there are some strong people left. But standards are very important. So you have define your terms, and then you have standards. And then you have to also create a system where if you go away on a holiday, it continues to work on its own. So that requires a lot of trust. That requires a lot of processes. No one's going to bag processes and bureaucracy. Management is actually an awesome thing once it keeps going. But it does need accountability. And accountability, of course, loops back into standards. And I think those are really the only ways you can do it. And you have to jump on things early, which is the whole point of management processes, that if things are followed correctly, then there will be no fire because there was no tinder and there was no spark. And I think I think this is important for people to understand that every day, every hour, every minute that they're involved in a community, it's all of their being. Their behavior dictates the future, because as soon as something gets slightly off the rails, people push on that door, and if it's open, they'll just go straight through because there's no real barriers that they can feel.
And this is how you basically get infiltration or entryism, where people it can infiltrate the organization because there's nothing really to stop them, and they can pretend like, oh, sort of use a lot of ambiguity and distance them, you know, try and make things as gray as possible, and won't commit to anything. And if you're soft, if there's no hard line, there's no fixed rules, these people can then move themselves around those rules and slowly work their way through organizations. And then you get that decay and that sort of destruction over time.
Well, it's very important to remember that unless you're very, very unlucky, or unless you've gotten the eyeballs of, say, the state or your enemy, you're unlikely to have an entryist person, an infiltration into your community or your group or your media or your business, whose job it is specifically to sabotage it or to introduce a counter narrative. You know, there's very few players, shall we say. There are far more volunteers. And those volunteers are really just doing what the mainstream says is everybody should do. You know, they've never actually thought deeply about it. It feels right because everybody else is doing it as well. That's how they get invited to the parties. When they speak on social media, they don't get censored. So this must be the right thing to say, even though it might have sounded a little spicy. They never get the censorship bans. So when they come in and the standards aren't being upheld, it's natural for them to act in a way that everybody else outside of that community is acting. And slowly, slowly, things just start to move towards, you know, your enemy, your enemy's position, through no real conscious effort of those people. They aren't to blame. They are just doing what they're told by the system, by the public, by the narrative. And so that's very important to differentiate between those people, because the players who may be purposefully trying to sabotage or infiltrate a narrative, they are dangerous. You should watch out for those. But actually, the volunteers, the people who are sort of just doing it off inertia, they aren't your enemy. In fact, those people are proving to you in real time that they have the ability to follow instruction, to be disciplined, to do what the crowd says, and to repeat back the narrative that they're hearing on the TV. Those are all four fantastic attributes of the perfect citizen. That's exactly who you want, or the perfect worker, or the perfect taxpayer. They're exactly the kinds of people you want behind you. You want the players to be far away and down a rabbit hole or a well or into prison or whatever. You don't want those guys around. But those volunteers, those people who are proving to you that they can follow orders, you want to be able to change their minds. They're not your enemy. But in order for them to change their mind, they need to be shown that your standards offer a better life for them, a better vision, more happiness, more wealth, more status, more access, whatever their currency is. You have to show them through your actions that they can get it through you, following you, joining your community, following the rules in your media organization or not. They will be out. If they decide to go off tangentially, they will be gotten rid of. And that will also send a message to the rest of the volunteers that maybe these standards are important, that the outside there are no standards, that I can just do whatever I want and I'm not even understanding where I'm getting my narrative from. But in here, the narrative is clear. We have defined our terms. We uphold our standards, and everybody does their job and responsibility, no matter who's around, no matter whether there's surveillance cameras or the editor is around or the CEO, everyone does it on their own. They can trust themselves and they can trust other people. That space actually is highly healthy. It's a beautiful civic space, but you have to maintain it.
And how do we maintain those sort of standards and rules without, say, infighting? And it's a difficult thing on the right sometimes to get people to stick together and to work together. Like you said, there's a lot of players too, people with their own ideas, people who clash. I've certainly had my fair experience of this in the last few years. And one of the things that really drew me to RCR and what Voices for Freedom was doing as well was like, oh, these are people who sort of got it together. And there was a, but then on that broader scene, you had a massive amount of fragmentation. And there is a phrase going around now that's becoming more popular on sort of the dissident right. This phrase, no enemies on the right. But how do you maintain sort of that idea of having no enemies on the right and also maintaining good discipline and good rules?
Well, one of the things the right, again, without wanting to define our terms, loosely speaking, the right, has been singularly bad on, probably throughout its entire existence, is quality control. You know, if you decide that rightism basically just means you're not left and you're angry at the system, oh, you can come and join our boat. That's a real struggle because you end up getting people who, and I've seen this, you know, to use our point from before, I've seen this a lot in churches where they'll just invite anybody in because, well, that's what it says in the Bible and you should probably be doing that. But you end up having this smorgasbord of mentally unfit, slightly insane, maybe narcissistic and controlling people, just a melting pot of things that just make things really hard, increase the friction of that institution.
Things and then you say, oh, but you have to get along, you know, you all have to be, it doesn't work.
Yeah. But I would say to that, so you start off with high quality people. You increase the barrier of entry. You again, go back to the standards and the rules you have, the definition of terms. If you are looking for certain kinds of people, but you will only allow the best people in, that's a great cadre to have of players. You're creating your own player network that you still have a lot of work to do, by the way, after that. But when you have a high quality network of people, you can get things done at speed. And I think what that flows into is realizing that none of that matters until you win. Winning is the most important thing in politics. It's the most important thing in elections. But at metapolitical levels where you change the narrative of society, you can only do that if you win completely over whoever you consider to be your enemies. The left is very good at that. They win first and then they decide what to do with the power that they've got. But they don't. There's no difference. I think I read in World War I, the anarchists put aside their differences with the communists because they realized, well, our job is just to kill a whole bunch of people and just create chaos. But the communists are kind of on that path too. So we're going to put aside our differences. And until we have won, we're not going to continue the anarchist movement. We're just going to keep going with the communist movement as well. The right, on the other hand, has really failed to do that. Over the 20th century, at least, there's been a lot more infighting in the right before they've won anything. There is one example that was the opposite, though, however, and that was the Spanish Civil War, where all of the different monarchical, republican, the nationalist groups decided to put all their differences aside and realize that the bigger enemy must be crushed first, and then they can squabble about all their internecine politics and different ways of looking at it and how they're going to create the utopia. But they had to win first. And when the right does that, it does win. It has the strength. But it's been, maybe it's because of the entryism, maybe it's because of laziness, maybe it's because of procrastination. Whatever it is, they always end up thinking, you know what, in this tiny little footstep race that we've just done the first step, I want to be the leader in the next step. And of course, they can't win the 100-meter race after that, because if you're fighting for every step, all the energy goes into changing direction rather than actually finishing. So I think that's important. Quality control, who you invite in, it must be kept high, those standards. And don't worry about politics, internal politics, until you actually have power. It's got a long way to go, but it is possible to do that.
Well, thank you very much. I have got a whole bunch more questions for you, and I'd love to talk more about the Spanish Civil War as well, but we're just out of time for today. So thank you very much for joining me, Nathan, and we will have you back on to continue this conversation at some point in the future.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.